With a sideways look at history, including discussions, reviews of alternate history media, and your comments, this is the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
And welcome to the very first Alternate History Show, the very first of its kind with me, at least. As the kindly voiceover has just pointed out, my name is Ben Kearns, and I hope you can stick with me for this three-part podcast into the wonderful world of alternate history. For the next 75 minutes, and throughout these shows in general, it is my sincere hope that you can be entertained, you can be wowed by some interesting facts you may not have known about history before, all while exploring what might have been in different realms, in different circumstances. Today, in our very first episode, it's all about World War II in focus, with the 80th anniversary of the start of that particular conflict, with the invasion of Poland by the Nazis and the declaration of war by the Allied powers. We're asking, could things have played out differently? Could the war have been prevented altogether? And might it have had a slightly different ending to it? And if so, how? We'll be asking all those questions in the next hour and a bit. I hope you can stay tuned and listen to all of the podcast. As I was saying, it is in three parts. It's not just about discussions, though. Throughout the show, one particularly famous piece of alternate history will be receiving the 60-second summary treatment from me. I'm going to tell you about The Man in the High Castle, the classic piece of AH by Philip K. Dick. In under a minute, have you been tempted to buy it? I know you have. Well, I'm going to tell you more about it a little later on in this hour. Plus, two people with a near brush with history. Two people who nearly were involved in the premature deaths of Adolf Hitler and Winston Churchill. We'll find out more about those two people and what they did afterwards and what they thought as well of their near brush with infamy. That's Almost Infamous coming up a little bit later on. And I'm pining for your involvement in the show, both reviewing this one and contributing to future episodes of the Alternate History Show. Details on how you can go about that or in the feedback hub, and that is coming up towards the end of today's show.
It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
You'll be pleased to know I won't just be talking about what may have happened in World War II differently by myself. I have a panel, albeit a panel of one, but what we lack in quantity, we well and truly make up for in quality with this guy. Alex Wallace is a prominent alternate historian, and he runs a very successful Facebook page, which we will talk more about a little bit later on. And he has been doing his research or what on this? Let me tell you. He's been doing so much research, I think he's even started creating a time machine so he can go back and actually change history to see what exactly would have happened for himself. Anyway, joins me now. Alex, hello.
Hello, Ben.
How are you doing?
Doing just fine. as he said, I go by Spanish Spy on alternatehistory.com.
Yes, that's how you frequent the alternate history pages, and you frequent many a page under the name Spanish Spy. Where does that come from, by the way?
Freshman year of high school, Model United Nations Conference. I was representing Ghana in an African Union committee, and the topic was unifying Africa under a single super state, and I was saying we should have, like, autonomous communities like Spain. And so I was recommending this a lot, and then somebody at the end said I was most likely to be the Spanish spy. That was like a month before I joined the Alternate History Wikia, and then I've used it ever since. Just, it's a nice name. I mean, I'm actually American, but like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm half Filipino. I've got some Catalonian ancestry if you go, like, way back there.
Oh, right. Okay. I did wonder whether there was any Spanish blood in you or anything like that, but there you go. All right. Let's get down to brass tacks, as they say, with World War II. And I want to start by talking about whether it could have been prevented in any way, shape, or form, because The Economist, as you probably know, John Maynard Keynes, who was at World War I, the conference ending World War I, World War One, which of course resulted in the Treaty of Versailles. He said in the book The Economic Consequences of the Peace that a war, if not inevitable, was there was very likely to be some sort of conflict. That's what I'm trying to get at. If not the war as we know it. So could it have been prevented in 1918 or later? Well, let it up. Well, the later the better, really.
Well, in my opinion, there's just so much left over from Versailles.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen. You have Poland becoming independent. You have all the shifting colonies.
Mm.
You have the actual punitive measures imposed by Versailles.
Mm.
And this is where my half Asian part's coming out. My reminder to you that World War II started in 1937 in China.
Mm.
And so the Japanese felt really screwed over that because they wanted Germany's Chinese colonies. They didn't get it, so they were mad.
Mm.
And so that's when they walk into Manchuria after Mukden, and then the rest of the country after Marco Polo Bridge. So, I mean, Versailles really set the stage for everything after 1939, honestly.
Mm.
And so something's going to happen.
Something, but not necessarily World War II? Not necessarily a second go of what happened in 1914?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. And alliances could definitely shift. There's Turtlov's War That Came Early series, which I didn't read that for the research here because I didn't want to read six books on a single scenario. I do remember it having Germany and Poland aligned against Russia.
And sure.
Another one, Shadow of Montreux by Pablo Portillo. He has Germany and Italy going to war over Austria in the 30s. And that was a scare for a while. It was the inspiration for some events in The Great Dictator by Chaplin, if memory serves.
Yeah, because everyone remembers the Pact of Steel and all that jazz, I suppose. But, of course, Hitler and Mussolini and Germany and Italy were very much on opposing sides over Austria before, say, the mid-1930s, weren't they?
Yeah.
But then again, if so many nations are stacked up against, say, Germany or the USSR or anyone like that, would that by itself make a World War II scenario sort of obsolete, because you wouldn't want to tackle all those nations? And if you did, then you're going to get a swift kicking.
One can say that, yes, but then Germany actually did it, so...
Yeah, yeah.
Never underestimate the irrational capability of dictators.
Very good point. Alright, so, yeah. So basically, some sort of conflict, as Keane says, is sort of inevitable, really, after 1918, but not necessarily the one that we know as World War II.
Yeah, it's... As Ferdinand Foch said, it's not a peace, it's an armistice for 20 years.
Yeah.
He was very prescient there.
Pretty much. I think he had it on the money there, I think. Alright, well, let's see if there could have been anything. Well, first of all, I like that idea. Let's explore that idea of Italy and Germany going to war over Austria. I mean, how would that have panned out? And would it have led to intervention from the likes of the UK, France, and the Allied powers, including the US?
So, what Pablo Portillo does in Shadow of Montreux is that the what we would call the Allied powers do not intervene. Italy ultimately wins, part because there's a split between the Italian fascists and the Nazis in Germany.
Yeah.
And, like, the rest of the fascists have to choose one or the other.
Mm.
And so the Romanian fascists... it's still King Carol.
Mm.
But King Carol, he sides with the Italians. He takes away Germany's oil supplies, and then the war effort in Germany just grinds to a halt, and the Italians win, and National Socialism is discredited in this world. Which I just thought was a very interesting book.
Mm.
Very interesting.
Very, very cool. I may have to read that, actually, at some point.
It's from Sea Lion Press.
What about in 1938? Because, of course, you had, by this point, the Pact of Steel was pretty much a solid pact. And although a lot of the Allied powers wanted to detach Mussolini from Hitler and that kind of stuff, you had the Munich crisis and the Munich conference. What if that had gone sour, so to speak? So you have war in 1938. I've heard it said that Hitler himself would have preferred a war at that point, but then I've heard it said from the Allied point of view that it would have been better for the Allies to have a war in 1938. Who's right in that equation? Is it wishful thinking on our behalf or on the Nazis' behalf?
I mean, I just think, in general, it's hard for Germany to win one of these wars.
Yeah.
I think that was the premise of the war that came early.
Yeah.
Eternal Love, the war over the Sudetenland.
Because it's interesting, because you get a lot of people in proclaiming that a 1938 war would probably end pretty swiftly in a few months. It would all be over by Christmas, to paraphrase a 1914 statement, so to speak. But then others would say, if not going on for 5 or 6 years, it would have dragged on till 1941, 1942, and would have been nearly as destructive as 1939 to 1945. So where do you see a 1938 war playing out? How do you see it playing out?
I think it would last at least a few years. It depends if Hitler is stupid enough to invade the Soviet Union. Which, granted, this is Hitler. He
probably would be, I would imagine.
I mean, Germany is just so logistically hard. Its logistics are so bad compared to the British and the French and the Russians that it's hard for them to win.
Mm.
I mean, there's a short story by R.M. Melloc in the first Alternate Generals anthology, in which the Germans get a much better Luftwaffe head, and he has several tactical victories, and it looks like the war is going okay for the Germans. And the Americans nuke Dresden, which I think goes to a very salient point that any tactical victory on the behalf of the Germans is just prolonging the inevitable.
Mm. Okay. So when do you think a 1938 war would have finished, to clarify? Sort of 1940 time, 41 at the latest.
40-41 if the Soviets don't enter, longer if the Soviets do enter.
Okay.
Or if the Germans invade the Soviet Union.
Which probably would happen, so I would hazard a guess that longer, basically, is what you're saying. Okay, so Munich Conference goes ahead, and it sort of plays out as our timeline does, until March 1939, when the Nazis invade Czechoslovakia. Why did the Allied powers, do you think, not declare war there and then? Because it was pretty obvious at that juncture that the Munich Agreement and what was said in Munich in September 1938 wasn't really worth the paper it was written on.
I mean, I've heard the theory that Neville Chamberlain was simply trying to buy time before the war.
Mm.
I mean, it's possible. I don't know the exact specifics, but it's definitely possible.
I've heard it said that that was the reason for the Munich Agreement in the first place, but whether that was wishful thinking or whether that was a lot of revisionist history or that or the like, I'm not overly sure myself. But so I suppose when we get to September 1939, it's probably going to happen there and then one way or another, of course, with the declaration of war on Poland, or the invasion of Poland by the Nazis, and the subsequent declaration of war. Is there any way it could have been postponed using a point of departure of March 1939, so to speak? So there is no... Basically, what I'm trying to ask is what would have happened had there been no declaration of war or no promise to go to the aid of Poland at that point. They're played for time again, even more, basically.
I mean, the British and the French are going to begin to be seen as very wishy-washy if they don't help Poland.
But then again, they were seen as wishy-washy in the first place, even in 1938.
I mean, but more than London and Paris are willing to accept.
Mm.
So it's possible that they do that and try to, like, be even better. In which case, I can see the war starting, like, maybe over, like, Norway or Finland? Yeah. Maybe the Low Countries?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah.
If the Germans invade Belgium, the British are intervening. That pretty much has to
be the starting gun, I suppose, for any sort of war. If the Germans invade Belgium, I suppose, which would be 1940 at the latest, presumably.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right, so it's September 1939, the Allies declare war. September the 3rd, I think the British eventually declared war. And it gets eventually to the Battle of France, the invasion of Norway and the Netherlands as well. How could they have been prevented? Because on paper, I suppose the Nazis have a lot more power than Norway or the Netherlands at that point. But could the British, say, have intervened to have prevented the invasion of Norway? What exactly could have been done that wasn't?
Wait. I'm not too familiar with the Norwegian front. I do know that one of the reasons why the Germans did not invade Britain is because Norway went so badly for them.
In which way?
It was logistically harder than they thought it would be.
Yeah.
So it's one of the reasons why they cancelled Sea Lion, which I think is an amusing thought given Sea Lion's reputation in all the history circles.
Yes.
And, like, if Norway goes better for them, they invade Britain. They probably lose when they invade Britain, but they'll do it.
Yeah. Okay.
Also, in this period, I want to, like, bring up the role of the Soviet Union, because remember, the Soviets invaded Poland with the Nazis.
Yes, they had an interesting role at this point, of course, with the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact in 1939. So that came in, and they were sort of, I've heard them described many a time as friendly enemies at this juncture in history.
I mean, Stalin went to the Germans because Britain and France didn't want anything to do with him. And so he was, my understanding, he was trying to buy time. I think it's interesting to note, though, that there was a secret protocol in the British and French agreement with Poland that agreement only applied to a German invasion, not a Soviet invasion.
Right.
I wonder what would happen if that secret protocol didn't make it in and they also declared war on the Soviet Union. Because for a while, they saw the Soviet Union as an Axis power.
Yeah.
If you read SSGB by Len Deaton, talking about a Soviet visit to German-occupied Britain and that they're taking out the corpse Karl Marx, going to bring it to Russia.
Well, of course, I've heard it said a while back that a lot of British politicians, one of the reasons they were trying to make peace with Hitler in 1938 into 1939 was because they saw the Nazis themselves as a bulwark against communism. So the kind of anti-communist, we do not want to work with the USSR attitude goes way back, I suppose. I guess to the 1917 Russian Revolution and beyond.
Yeah, exactly. There was the whole Allied intervention in Russia when they landed in Arkhangelsk and then Vladivostok, and that Czech Legion that got lost. Because there was definitely always elements in the West who said, "To hell with the communists, and we'll take the fascists over them."
Yeah.
I mean, George Patton said similar. Said after we beat Germany, we should arm them and fight the Russians. And many were at least considering it. You had Operation Unthinkable in Britain. I think it was Churchill's plans.
Let's move on to the fall of France now, of course, which happened in June of 1940. The battle was going on from around about May to June. How could that have been prevented? How could that have been prevented? Because it's ironic, really. You get the juxtaposition of, before the war started, the French being particularly reluctant and the British being particularly reluctant to enter a war with Germany because they feared the Luftwaffe. But then on the other hand, in 1940, you get a lot of the neutrals, including the US, who were officially, while we remember, were still neutral at this point. A lot of them were very surprised at the fall of France. Was that mainly the public that was surprised? Was that wishful thinking that they wouldn't have to get involved with the war, I suppose? And how could the French have won the Battle of France?
I read a book on the Battle of Britain, and actually a good half the book was on France. Battle of Britain by James Holland, which is a good book.
It a lot. It's kind of a precursor, I suppose, to the Battle of Britain as well, isn't it? Very much.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it was talking about the French, like blow by blow in France for like the first 300 pages, 600 page book. So, I mean, I think there was a lot of doctrinal issues among both British and French. It's the sort of thing that I think that the Germans would eventually lose, just because they're just... Districts weren't good. Their tactical practices among the Luftwaffe in particular were not great. Luftwaffe pilots were expected to just bomb.
I have heard it said that it was a lot better use for, say, quick in-out type of operations, so to speak. Is that what you're trying to say? But with a long campaign in France, they'd have been bogged down, and the French would, say, win a battle of attrition.
I mean, what I meant by that is that compared to the British pilots, they got leave. They were mandated 8 hours rest a night.
Mm.
So you just had the Luftwaffe succumbing to exhaustion, quite literally. And so the Germans had this very this unforgiving regiment of orders for their pilots. And eventually it would break down if they don't implement reforms. And given that this is the Nazis we're talking about, it's not going to happen.
No. Okay. So basically it would have... Yeah. And what would be the consequences, do you think, of an invasion, a successful Battle of France for the French? How long would the war take to be over at that point? And what would be the knock-on effects, I suppose, for Barbarossa? Because... As we said earlier on, the Germans and the USSR at that point were on friendly terms. So what would happen?
I mean, that might actually end poorly for the Soviets, because if the Germans aren't having to deal with the war in the West, they could throw everything at the Russians. Still wouldn't necessarily mean they'd win, but they'd have more to throw into the Russian meat grinder.
Mm.
And depending on what Italy does, they won't have to with North Africa either.
Mm.
You wouldn't have Operation Torch, you wouldn't have the battle in North Africa, Italy, you wouldn't have D-Day.
Mm.
So, if
it's done purely on one front, they will have a better chance of at least pulling out a victory, but pulling off something that could look like a victory to the people at home, basically.
Yes. Mm. I mean, at least like a negotiated settlement in France.
Yeah.
Maybe take Alsace-Lorraine. Maybe take a couple of slivers of Belgium and Luxembourg. Yeah.
Well, let's move on from the Battle of France and assume that goes the way it did in real life, and move on to the Battle of Britain, which took place over the British skies. Now, I've heard a lot of people say that pretty much it was predetermined from the get-go how that was going to go, but what's the closest we can get to a Nazi victory at the Battle of Britain, and what would it look like?
You avoid that shift where the Luftwaffe ceases bombing airfields and starts bombing London.
Yeah.
If they focus on RAF airfields, they will do much better. But the thing is, you know, these are Nazis we're talking about, and they live for that big symbolic strike, so it's a temptation that they're always going to have.
They're
going to
bomb London because of the political consequences as they see it. I suppose.
Yes. I mean, I've seen it argued that fascism is politics as a spectacle, as aesthetic.
Mm.
And I think, at least in part, that can be shown in the Nazi war effort, them going for London, especially for Stalingrad, because one of the reasons Hitler went for Stalingrad because they met for Stalin.
Mm.
Granted, it also gave the Soviets access to the Baku oil fields. But there was a strategic reason to go for it, but there... It being named after the enemy leader was one of the reasons why Hitler's ego was felt compelled to go for it.
It's got to be done, that kind of thing, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's the issue with the Nazis. They want to do these, frankly, kind of stupid things for reasons that aren't strictly military. That's why it's so hard to have them win.
Yeah. Basically, the personalities get in the way, that kind of stuff. So, yeah. Okay. And if they would win, it wouldn't be, they wouldn't be the Nazis, basically. Pretty much. So what would be the best that they could hope for from the Battle of Britain? They're bombed airfields, so to speak.
I mean, if they...
What would happen then?
If they focus solely on the infrastructure...
Yeah.
The best they can get is a negotiated settlement,
yeah,
and ending the U-boat war and ending the British blockade of Germany.
Yeah.
Trying to normalize relations with the rest of the world and casting themselves as the anti-communists when they go and beat up the Russians.
Mm.
That's probably the best they can get from the Battle of Britain, realistically.
You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns and Alex Wallace at the moment. More in part two as me and Alex chew the fat over the invasion of Russia, Operation Barbarossa, as it was called. Plus, the 60-second summary presents The Man in the High Castle. That's all in part two. See you for that in a moment.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said.
Well, let's focus on the Russian invasion now, Barbarossa, as it's called. Of course, it was fairly costly to both sides. But how do you see things going differently from the invasion in June 1941? I mean, it doesn't make any sense logistically, I suppose, for the invasion to take place at that point, given that the Nazis were fighting on the Western Front already, as you say, but how could that have gone better for the Russians initially? Because it did take a while as well to get them to retreat from Moscow, didn't it?
Yeah, the Germans went pretty well into the country. I mean, have Stalin be less paranoid and not purge as many people in the 30s, but the thing is, that
Stalin wouldn't be Stalin.
Not being Stalin.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the issue with, like, a lot of, like, politics between Berlin and Moscow in this period.
Yeah.
The people who are in charge are just so crazy, and they're so powerful, too, that they're not going to not be crazy.
Yeah.
So some of this stuff is inevitable.
Mm.
And so it's also the reason why the Germans pissed off the Ukrainians they were working with.
Yes.
That they tried to, like, marginalize them and not arm the Ukrainians to be used as an army against the Russians, because, you know, the Ukrainians had every reason to be mad at the Soviets. Same with the Baltics.
Turning our attention now to the invasion of Greece and other European countries, how should that have panned out? Because there was actually Lend-Lease, which we'll come to in more detail in a little while. But the Lend-Lease program, I suppose, did extend partly to other European countries such as Greece, but too little, too late, I suppose, for a Nazi invasion. What would have been the consequences of perhaps a far less successful invasion of Greece due to extra funds being deployed in that department and perhaps more assistance from the Allied powers?
I mean, the best I think the Greeks can get is, like, bogging down the Germans yet in another front.
Yeah.
It's similar to what happened in Yugoslavia. Honestly, this part of the war isn't my strong suit.
No.
So, I mean, you have to, like, look in the broader schema here. If you can bog down the Germans as much as possible in Greece, the less they have to use in France than to use in Russia.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we're going to move on, and we're now going to talk about, well, we're getting to 1941, well into 1941, actually. And let's see, let's have a look at the American involvement in World War II, of course, because they came on board after the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. Could that have been prevented in any way, shape, or form? We know that FDR and a lot of people around him, and a lot of the public, after the fall of France in particular, were very much sort of thinking that they needed to get involved in 1941, beyond, of course, Lend-Lease and being a sort of a neutral power, albeit on the Allied side. I mean, could that have, could the US have been kept neutral at least for longer? And could they have come in earlier as well, actually?
I mean, earlier is hard. It depends on what Japan does and what Germany does after Japan attacks.
Yeah.
Because the Japanese are just waiting to pounce on the European colonies in East Asia.
Yeah.
And
I guess the rationale to a certain degree as well is we need to get the Americans involved now and deal with them before they build up their strength, because they were at that point building up their, they'd had the biggest peacetime, build-up of defences.
Yeah, I mean, there was a draft going on before the formal American entry into the war.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to change that, change Japan's supply situation, because they wanted to, Americans, they embargoed Japan, food, sell them oil, and that was having the war in China go very poorly.
Yeah.
And so they needed to invade somewhere to get those resources, and so they attacked Hawaii to knock out the American fleet. Didn't go as well as they had hoped, but have Pearl Harbor go better and, like, thoroughly destroy the base, that would help them.
Yeah.
It helps with knocking out American capacity to deploy forces into the Asia-Pacific region.
Yeah.
It's what was called in my international security class in college Anti-Axis Area Denial, or A2AD. Not necessarily destroying the enemy's capacity to make forces, but the enemy's capacity to ship forces to where they need to be. So if they can, like, destroy Pearl Harbor, destroy Hawaii's use as a way of getting troops from the mainland U.S. to the Asia-Pacific theater, that will help them.
Okay.
And they can help to take out the Philippines, destroy the Philippines there, destroy the force of the Philippines, and then they can take Vietnam and Indonesia, etc.
I mean, what would that do exactly to the length of the war? I'm assuming that at some point they're going to slip up, but how long do you envisage that taking, and how much more costly could that be?
I mean, I could add up to a year to the Americans, because they need to retake Hawaii, and then go on the island hopping campaign. And that time, the Japanese could be using the time to cement their hold in China and in Burma, have the war against the British in India and Burma go better, put down resistance in the China and Indonesia and the Philippines, and just generally consolidate these holdings, and they'd be better equipped to fight the Americans should they'd be bogged down. It all depends, of course, on how well they fortify Hawaii.
I've heard it said a lot of the time that it could have been, and some people have actually posed this. I've seen a couple of questions on the Alternate History Forum regarding this, but the idea that the US could have declared war only on Japan or prioritised the Japanese attack, the response to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, how would that have affected things, and how would that have played out?
If that's the case, that the Germans do better, but the Japanese do worse. I've read some reception to the decision to orient the war into war against Europe, the American effort against Germany. Manuel Quezon, the president of the Philippines on American rule, he said something like, "How very American to to weep at the fate of a distant cousin while your own daughter is being raped in the back room." I read that in Stanley Carno's book on American rule in the Philippines, and I thought that's very emblematic of how the Filipinos saw this shift.
Mm.
And so it depends a lot on an individual command. I can see the Philippines being retaken earlier and Japan being destroyed easier. It also depends on how the war in China goes.
Yeah.
How well do the communists versus the Kuomintang go? In which I can definitely see the Japanese being defeated by like 44 if the Americans do not fight in Europe.
Yeah.
But consequently, you have the Germans doing better.
Mm.
And it also depends if the West is still getting the lease.
Yeah.
Because, like, I do know that Australian and New Zealand troops in Europe were sent back to the Pacific because their own countries were being threatened.
Yeah.
So you can have just, like, America not wanting to get involved there. I mean, of course, though, it depends on whether Hitler declares war on the U.S. after the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. And this, again, goes into... I mean, Hitler's crazy, and so it requires Hitler to not be Hitler, which isn't going to happen because Hitler is Hitler.
Pretty much. I guess, say, if all this happens, if the US concentrates on Japan and the Japanese are out of the war by 1944, do they then, do the US, I suppose, then turn their attention to the European field after that and fight the Germans and the Italians, assuming the Italians are still in the war because of the butterflies brought about by the lack of a US presence?
I mean, the North African War had begun before the American entry because of the Al-Alamein fighting in Egypt. And so it's possible for the British and the French to triumph in North Africa. I don't know how well it would have gone in Italy, whether they would have invaded Sicily and Italy and do something similar to what happened in OTL without the Americans. It would be definitely harder. It depends on whether Lend-Lease is still being given to Britain, to France, to Greece, and the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
If they just take it out entirely, the Nazis are much better.
Mm.
They could. It depends what the Nazis do. Do they do Stalingrad? Because that was a mess. The common thing I see among our works to try to be more plausible is that the Germans succeed in taking the Baku oil fields and cut off the Soviet oil supplies, which is what Fatherland did.
Yeah.
And which I think a few other things did.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's move on. Let's move on to... Let's go into 1943, actually. And I want to talk about the Italian... The Italian surrender, I suppose, and the invasion of Sicily. Now, the idea behind this, the idea behind the concentrating on the invasion of Sicily was to get to separate the two allies, basically. Separate the two Axis allies. Yes. Germany and Italy. Get Italy out of the war first and then turn your attention fully to Germany. How effective was that? Because I've heard it said a lot of the time that Italy declaring war on the Allies in some ways exacerbated a lot of problems for the Germans. So, I mean, did we do them a favour in a way, knocking the Italians out in 1943, or was it mainly, or did it mainly affect morale, or was it actually a good thing, and was it an obvious thing to do?
I mean, one of the things that Italy dragged down Germany is that They got him into the quagmire that was North Africa. I mean, if you knock out Italy, yes, the Germans don't have to fight in North Africa, but they have to fight in Italy. which is like one of the reasons why they opened the Italian front, is to take forces away from the Eastern Front.
Yeah.
And so if they don't invade Italy, they have more German divisions going into Russia.
Yeah.
And you still have Italy, like, doing things in France. Might take Nice, because Nice was Italian at one point. They couldn't take North Africa after Al-Qatar, or the fall of Tunis and Bizerte. So, I mean, as I said, a lot of this stuff is just delaying the inevitable for Germany. It's just a matter of how much.
Okay. Let's move on, and let's switch a little bit forward to 1944. Let's talk D-Day, shall we now? Let's talk D-Day, and actually, let's, before we do that, talk about the Chinese cooperation in the war, because that's not so well known, is it? It's not so well known.
Yeah.
I mean, they were on the Allied side, and as I understand it, the Chinese and the Japanese have been at each other's throats for a while, but Germany, until the Third Reich came along, had sort of an alliance, albeit slightly uneasy, with China, and it was changed to Japan in the early days of the Third Reich. So, I mean, what was the rationale behind that, if there was indeed a rationale? And, I mean, why was China involved in the war, basically?
I mean, China was involved because Japan just wouldn't let them, like, be China. They wanted Manchuria. They wanted a co-prosperity sphere, and that's in quotes.
Ah.
And so, I mean, the Japanese are going to take it. The Chinese are going to be the victims. It's a matter of how well the Chinese fight.
Yeah.
Do the Chinese fight well in Shanghai? Because if they win the Battle of Shanghai, which was one of the early battles of the war, they can nip the Japanese invasion in the bud easily.
Mm.
There or at Nanjing, one of the big. The big turning points was the Battle of Suzhou. If that was a crushing Chinese defeat, there was a victory before it at Taiyuan. If the Chinese can rout the Japanese at Suzhou, they can do better.
Yeah.
They can, like, keep the Japanese close to the coast.
That would presumably as well cause more troops to be driven to the Pacific front as well, and the Chinese front to try and contain what was going on, I guess.
Yeah, there's a point of divergence here that I think that not many people have done.
Yeah.
There was a big row between Chiang Kai-shek and the Americans.
Yes.
When the Americans wanted the Chinese to allow an American general named Joseph Stilwell to command the entirety of the Chinese army.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Chiang Kai-shek was understandably not happy with it.
No.
So they eventually sacked Stilwell, had somebody else take command of the American presence in China. But what would have happened had Stilwell been put in charge of Chinese forces?
Had
my understanding is that he led a incursion into Burma by Chinese forces that didn't go very well, so I'm not inclined to believe it'd be done pretty well, but on the other hand, Chiang Kai-shek's armies weren't exactly the most
organized
either. There's the whole thing about destroying the dams on the Yangtze that killed a bunch of people, that made a lot of people mad at him, made the communists more popular, so you could have, like, Chiang Kai-shek not be as much of a, to put Wong in ass as he was, like, not have him destroy those dams and, like, kill a bunch of people who otherwise could help him. That would be a point in his favor. Have the 100 regiments offensive by the communists fail, so the communists are weaker, and have China go nationalist after the Japanese are kicked. That's another point of divergence.
There's a lot to talk about with the Chinese. Of course, you had the Chinese Civil War not long afterwards as well, so that was ongoing pretty much. So I'm guessing if China do better in the Second World War, then there's more time to perhaps for Chiang Kai-shek and his team, I suppose, to make sure that Mao doesn't come to at least most of China. He may have a part of it in the end, I suppose, like Taiwan, I suppose, with Chiang with Shek, of course. But yeah, basically it could have gone better and the civil war could have gone smoother, basically. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, it could have also could have gone worse, because there were a couple of incidents during the war where, despite the Japanese being in China, there were shootouts between communists and nationalists. There was this thing during the 100 Red Regiment offensive where the communists went on a nationalist territory, and the nationalists were like, get out, and the communists were like, no. So you could have had this split between communists and nationalists, and you can have the Japanese take advantage of this. Ichigo offensive goes better, at least for a while, and then that all depends on how the Pacific theater goes, also how the Burmese theater goes.
Yeah. There's a lot of overlapping theatres, a lot of things going on, and a lot of aspects that could affect things, basically, with the as far as the Chinese front is concerned and how China does in the war. I say, like you say, it's an interesting thing to discuss because it's not discussed as often as it should be. I must confess, before we started doing this, I had not much of a clue, even less of a clue than I do now, about how exactly China helped and what exactly happened during the war, as far as China was concerned. I knew they were part of it, of course, but very interesting. This is the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns here for the next 45 minutes or so, and you're listening to me in conversation with Alex Wallace. More from Alex in about 10 minutes time as we talk D-Day and alternate outcomes to the end of World War II. That's on its way. First of all, it's time for this.
The Alternate History Show presents the 60-second summary.
And this is where I review a piece of alternate history. It could be literature, it could be a drama, it could be an alternate history film, or it might be, oh, I don't know, something completely different. As long as it's a piece of alternate history media and fits into the alternate history genre, that's what we're interested in this segment of the show. And I thought we'd start with a classic today, The Man in the High Castle, the 1962 book by Philip K. Dick. Are you one of those people that haven't yet read it? Are you one of those alternate history fans who have heard about it, perhaps maybe watched the TV and the film adaptations, but never really got round to reading the official book? I suppose you could say it is very much the war and peace of alternate history in that regard for a lot of people. Anyway, I'm going to sell it to you in 60 seconds. Tell you why you should be reading The Man in the High Castle if you haven't done so already, or maybe you want to refresh your memory as I did. Anyway, 60 seconds on this piece of alternate history literature starting now. The Man in the High Castle was written and set in 1962 America, 15 years after the capitulation of the US forces to the Nazis and the Japanese. It was set 15 years after the end of the Second World War, and the US is now divided into two nations, one run by the Germans and one run by the Japanese. And the Japanese in particular are very interested in Americana, as they call it. So memorabilia from before the Second World War in this timeline. And that is basically what the alternate history is about, largely selling antiques and uncovering the past and uncovering feelings of the past. The point of departure is in 1933 when Zangara kills Franklin Roosevelt and is succeeded, therefore, by John Nance Garner. And the nightmare carries on from there, and I've run out of time, haven't I? So there you go. That's enough for you to go on. Go and buy The Man in the High Castle when you can. It's the Alternate History Show with me, Ben Kearns, for another 25 minutes or so. We've got one part of the podcast left. And coming up in part three of the show, the two men who had a near brush with infamy, one of them nearly killing Adolf Hitler in battle, and another one running over Winston Churchill in New York. The accident nearly proved fatal. We'll hear more about the two men concerned about their lives generally, as in almost infamous, later on in the programme. Plus, details on how you can get involved in the Feedback Hub. We want your reviews, your critiques of this particular show, and we want you to get involved in future episodes as well. Maybe as a guest could happen. And we'll return to our current guest, Alex Wallace, in the next part of the show, looking at D-Day and the end of World War II. It's all coming up in part three. Do join me if you can.
The Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns. In association with AlternateHistory.com, the world's premier alternate history discussion site.
Okay, let's move on to D-Day and the invasion, the reoccupation, not invasion, the reoccupation of France in 1944. What we do know, of course, is that General Eisenhower at the time had a speech in case D-Day was a failure, which I suppose it could well have been in that case. Lots of people considered it highly risky. Didn't they? So, I mean, how could the invasion of France have gone worse for the Allies? And what could have happened?
I mean, there's the whole thing about that those German divisions that didn't get moved because Hitler was asleep. They didn't want to wake him up. So if they like just wake him up and those divisions go,
that's one of my favourite points of departure, actually, as far as this is concerned. So have someone, Hitler sleeping could have affected things. Carry on.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think by this point, especially after Stalingrad is decided decisively in favor of the Soviets, the Germans are doomed. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
I go back to that R.M. Melek story. I mean, if D-Day doesn't go as well as it does, and the war is dragged out for a few more months, nukes go off over Germany. Yeah. They nuke the Ruhr, they nuke Dresden, they nuke several other cities, probably in Bavaria too. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
It's a matter of when, but it's also a matter of how it ends as well, I suppose.
Yes.
So, I mean, is it an automatic, definite, if D-Day goes badly, and if, you know, it's, if it happens, 1945, the war is still going on, a nuke definitely flies? Is that definitely going to happen? Is that pretty much, there's going to be a German city that gets a nuke at least?
Yes, I do believe that is the case. The reason why the atomic bomb was developed in the U.S. to begin with was to be used on Germany. There's a whole letter by a dissident German scientist to Roosevelt saying, build a nuke or the Germans will get it.
Mm.
The only reason they didn't use it against the Germans in the real world is because they wasn't ready by the time the Germans surrendered.
Yeah.
Had the war gone on in Europe, they would have nuked Germany.
Recap on the targets that would have been up for nuking, so to speak, and how would that have affected things? Because at that point, you know, we'd have the Allies would have nuked part of Germany. I mean, how would that have affected the post-war world, I suppose?
The Western Allies are definitely in a better spot compared to the Soviets,
right,
in this world.
I mean, would there not be some sort of residual, perhaps, ill feeling towards the Allies from the Germans because, not because the war ended the way it did, but because of the nuclear bomb?
It's
and
possible.
Could that have affected things? I mean,
there was a token German resistance briefly during the occupation.
Yeah.
Turtelov's novel, The Man with the Iron Heart,
yes,
has that going a lot better.
Right.
And you can
in what way? In what way? Not to give many spoilers, but how exactly could it have gone better?
So what happens is that in this novel, Reinhard Heydrich survives his assassination in Czechoslovakia.
Is that the point of divergence for Fatherland as well, out of interest?
That That's one of them, yes.
Ah, right, okay.
Also, Man in the High Castle, one of, at least something with a show.
Yeah.
Right. So Man in the Ironheart, Heydrich survives. He is tasked by Himmler to lead an insurgency in occupied Germany after the war is lost. And so they start acting a lot like Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. They have truck bombs, they have suicide bombs, they have IEDs. They hijack planes, and they basically just make life hell for the occupying Allied authorities.
Yeah. Sort of going underground, if you like, retreating, but not fully retreating. Yeah. Okay. I mean, what would be the consequences of that generally? I mean, would the Cold War, for example, assuming this goes really badly, have unfolded as quickly as it did in real life, given that the US, the Allies, and the USSR still have a common enemy, albeit a less powerful one?
I mean, I think that there is going to be cooperation, but it's going to be with clenched teeth.
Right.
I think they will still be at each other's throats in Asia.
Yeah.
I think that there's a real possibility that the German insurgency could eventually have the Allies just withdraw in ignominious defeat, just because the electorates get fed up with it.
Yes. That pretty much problem. Like, in a way, like Iraq and Afghanistan, late 2000s, really.
I mean, the man with the Iron Heart is a not-so-subtle commentary on the War on Terror.
Right, yeah.
And so it ends with the Americans withdrawing and hinting that the Nazis could come back to power in the West. But he does make the very salient point that it doesn't work as much against the Soviets, because they're an autocracy and they're willing to kill a lot more people. I mean, they say that there are two ways to beat an insurgency. There is either mitigate the circumstances that make the insurgency attractive, or you kill every single man, woman, and child who is willing to be a part of the insurgency at any point. The Soviets, I think, are much more willing to do the latter than the Western Allies.
Yeah.
So they have a better chance of, like, taking the gloves off and engaging in rather morally questionable things.
Mm. Well, because, of course, in real life, most notably Albert Speer, in particular, who was, of course, imprisoned after the trials, and the US and the Allies wanted him released sooner than his impending date, but, of course, that didn't happen because the USSR said, no, it's not going to happen, he's got to serve all of his sentence, and more besides, if necessary. So we sort of see that rationale developing even then, even in real life, I suppose.
Yeah.
Mm.
Definitely. I mean, given how brutal the Soviet Union treated Germany in the real world was,
yeah.
There's insurgency, it is going to be ugly.
Yeah.
Really ugly on behalf of the Soviets.
Mm.
And just, you're going to see, like, mass executions. In that Turtle Love novel, they start using Nazi camps, like, not gas chambers, but, like, as internment camps. In the way that the British did in the Boer War in Kenya and Malaya, like, the original concentration camp.
Yeah.
Like, the original concentration camp, the rationale is, you've heard that Mao saying, the insurgent is a fish among the sea of the people.
Yes.
The logic of concentration camps in these insurgent wars is to take the sea and put it in jars.
Mm.
So you know where it is, and the revolutionaries can't get in. This almost always leads to humanitarian atrocities in these camps, but it worked in the Boer War, it worked in Kenya, it worked in Malaya.
Mm.
You are going to have a lot of innocent people die, but
as a result,
it can work.
Yeah.
It did not work in all cases in the real world. Did not work with the French in Algeria. Did not work in Vietnam. But it did work in South Africa, worked in Kenya, worked in Malaya.
But at the same time, you know, I guess you will inevitably be getting a lot of protests, a lot of homegrown protests against such a plan, such a move in the US and allied countries, I suppose, as well.
I mean,
not so much in the Soviet Union, but definitely in US capital.
I mean, I don't know whether the Western allies would be willing to do that to, let's be honest, other white people.
Mm.
But then again, the British did do it to Boers in South Africa.
Yeah.
So if they make enough of a nuisance of themselves, they could do it.
Yeah.
Britain definitely, because I've always been of the impression that the British were far more willing to like inflict pain upon the Germans than the Americans were.
Yeah.
Because, like, it was the RAF who did, like, night bombing.
Yeah.
It was a British general who ordered Dresden.
Sort of retaliation for the Blitz, if you like.
Oh, totally was. Totally.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the British would be willing to do it more than the Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, the Americans did use similar techniques in the Philippines when they're crushing their insurgency in the early 20th century. I mean, I think it's possible that they could do it in Germany. I mean, they were putting, like, they did keep the sentences of several homosexuals in prison under the Nazi regime.
Mm.
So there is precedent.
Yeah.
So, and, like, there also was the whole disarmed enemy combatant thing, and, like, a couple tens of thousands of German POWs starved because they weren't technically POWs, but the food was going to civilians, so I don't know.
That's difficult to say.
That's a blight on Eisenhower's record, but yeah, difficult to say.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's move on, because we've still got a little bit to talk about regarding the end of the war. And assuming everything goes as badly as it does, D-Day is a failure, and eventually a nuke comes into contact with a German city, etc., etc. And we get to what we do afterwards, because, of course, in real life, you had the Marshall Plan, which rebuilt part of Europe and Japan as well. And of course, you had competing ideas of what to do after the victory, because of course you had the Marshall Plan, but you also had the idea of the Morgenthau Plan, which was pretty much a scorched earth policy, as you were saying just a little while ago. So I guess my question is, would logistically such a plan as the Marshall Plan be possible after a nuke fell on a German city, given the more destructive nature of a nuclear weapon, I suppose?
I mean, I think that if it's not the Marshall Plans, we know it's going to be something like that, because the Americans, the British, are going to want a Germany that is strong but also listens to them, so they can fight the Russians. Because there was a very common belief that the West and the Russians were going to go to war.
Mm. But then again, at the same time, the Western allies are pretty much out of cash due to the Second World War and due to the presumed increased length of the war and the eventual the way it came to an end. So my question, I suppose, is would it logistically be able to be implemented, such a plan, in Japan and Germany?
I still think it could. Britain has the empire. America has its own informal empire in Latin America. I mean, American pressure was why so much Latin America declared war on the Germans in the waning days of World War II. And so I think there's still plenty of resources that America can use in Latin America. I still think that they would be rebuilding Germany and Japan to use against the Russians. I think, in fact, that the Americans and the British are in a better post-war situation than in the real world, because they have used and they have demonstrated the power of what they can do to the Russians, and so it puts more pressure on the Russians to get a nuke. So
yeah,
it's a better early few years for the Americans and British, but honestly, it might get uglier down the line.
Yeah, So basically, you'd want as many people on your side as possible, and you try to do it by so-called soft power, basically.
Yes.
And that's the gist of the conversation with Alex regarding alternate outcomes to World War II. Don't fear, though, because we're going to hear more from him in about 5 minutes' time. Coming up, we'll be talking about how you can get involved in future programmes and details on how you can present your feedback on this one. And as we're saying, interact with us, even if you're feeling a bit shy and don't want to get involved in future alternate history shows directly. That's coming up on the Feedback Hub. Plus, we'll be sharing our alternate history picks of the week. Intrigued? Stay tuned. Right now, it's time for Almost Infamous. This is the part in the show which I have been talking about, where I tell you about two people who had a near brush with infamy. And we're going to start by talking about a guy called Henry Tandy, who has earned his place in the history books, even in real life, really. He was born in 1891 and was one of the only people to receive a Victoria Cross when he was still alive. This is after his actions during a battle on September the 28th of 1918, when he was part of the Duke of Wellington's 5th Regiment. Mr. Tandy stayed behind during a battle, even though he was wounded, and would not leave until it was over, until the British Army in this particular battle were victorious. He won, say, a Victoria Cross for his actions during that day. His brush with infamy that we're talking about today, though, came on that very day, actually, September the 28th of 1918, when he was said to have encountered a German soldier who was wounded and didn't even raise his rifle. Despite this, Mr. Tandy let him go and didn't shoot him. The soldier purported to have nodded his head in thanks and went on his way. This would have been a forgotten incident had it not been for the fact that the German soldier in question was purported to be the Führer of Germany in 1937, Adolf Hitler, of course. The incident came to Hitler's attention thanks to an Italian friend of his, who was also an artist, who got a painting from another Italian friend. A bit of Chinese whispers going on here, I think. And the painting was purported to have shown Tandy at his gallant best. Basically, as say, overcoming his wounds and doing what he did best and trying to get various people out of the way, various soldiers in his battalion. Hitler recognised the painting, supposedly. He was, of course, an artist himself back in the day. And it was thought by Hitler that Tandy was the man who he encountered, and that he was the soldier, the German soldier, who he let go. He in fact mentioned this to British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain in 1938 when they were discussing their wartime experiences. And this was when, of course, Chamberlain was in Munich negotiating what would later become the Munich Agreement. Hitler asked Chamberlain to pass on his best regards to Tandy, which he apparently did, although records from BT are sketchy as to whether that actually happened or not. However, we do know that the incident did get back to Tandy and he did know about it. In fact, after the bombing of Coventry, a journalist asked him about it and he said, "I wish I'd got rid of him there and then in 1918. I wish I'd shot Hitler. If I'd known what he'd turn out to be, I would have done." However, it is sketchy as to whether it was actually Hitler that he let go, as Hitler was purported to be on military leave at the time. However, it is kind of up in the air. It is very much disputed as to whether or not Tandy encountered Hitler. However, what we do know is that Hitler claimed it, possibly because he wanted to be associated with someone who won the Victoria Cross. for gallantry and bravery. So we're not overly sure whether it did happen or not, but it's an interesting story, isn't it? If it did happen, it did. Yeah, anyway. Mr. Tandy eventually was discharged from the army in 1926, working for the police and working for a motor company. He tried to re-enlist in 1940, however, due to his age, at 49 then, he was not permitted to re-enlist in the army. However, he did keep close ties, as you can imagine. He died childless in 1977 at the age of 86. However, he was still married to Edith. His medals were donated back to the Duke of Wellington's 5th Battalion, where they were presented on a regular basis. And Tandy would actually go in and talk about them and present his medals to various people so they could wear. Very interesting stuff. All right, moving on to the second guy now. A guy by the name of Edward Contesino, who was an unemployed mechanic. He was born in 1905, and at the time of his near brush with infamy, was an unemployed mechanic. His brush with infamy came in December of 1931, December the 13th, when Winston Churchill was over in New York and wasn't looking where he was going. He was running late for a meeting with his friend, a financier who lived in New York. However, he got out, he disembarked from his taxi. And very interestingly enough, he was, in a real hurry and forgot that New Yorkers and people from the US drive on the other side of the road. And therefore, he ran straight into Contesino, who was driving at the time near to Churchill, ran him over. Mr. Contesino was reportedly grief-stricken as a result of it, but as we know, Mr. Churchill made a full recovery, and at the inquiry said it was entirely Churchill's fault. He admitted to it being his fault, and basically, it was reported as misadventure. Churchill did try and help Contesino financially as a result, and they did actually meet at the Waldorf Hotel 8 days later after Churchill's discharge from hospital. However, Mr. Contesino wouldn't accept any financial benefit from Churchill. It's not known whether he knew about what happened eventually, but of course, we imagine he would have done, really, because of Churchill's face being instantly recognisable. However, there was no more comment from Mr. Contesino regarding what exactly happened. He did, however, enlist in the army in World War II, fighting with the US from 1941 to 1945, and later went on to rejoin the mechanical trade, dying on January the 17th of 1989. So that actually did happen. We know that actually did happen, the encounter with Contesino and Churchill.
This is the Feedback Hub.
Right, let's do the Feedback Hub now. This is the first of these. It's where we're basically going to be talking about what's online and what we're doing, basically. We want your interactions. We want your listener feedback. And Alex wants to hear from you on Facebook in particular. Yeah. You run a very, very successful Facebook page dedicated to alternate history. Give it a plug.
Yes, please join Alternate History Online if you haven't already.
Yeah.
Also, I do help run a smaller forum.
Yeah.
The Alternate Timelines forum run by Lord Roll Hendrix. There too. It's a wonderful small place. It's not as big and politicized as alternatehistory.com is.
Yep.
So if you want that smaller environment, we're here too. So those two are my big involvement in the community.
In alternate timelines, is that specifically a timeline issue, or does What If queries get published as well?
It's just a general AH site, just smaller than most of the others.
Yeah.
So you are welcome to join both of those. It's a different atmosphere in each, but we can. I'll take comments and criticism in either one.
Mm. What is the difference? What is the difference in atmosphere, I suppose?
I mean, the Facebook group, it's very oriented around asking what ifs and less right. around, like, formal works because yes. of the nature of Facebook. It's
yeah.
An individual post is far more
you can only do
than,
so much and then it crashes.
Yeah.
In my experience, anyway.
Whereas... on a forum, you can have, like, long-running timelines, which I think that's why forums will continue to be useful to the community. I do not think that the community will go all the way to Facebook.
No.
For that very reason. I wrote a op-ed on Matt Mitrovich's Alton History Weekly update while that was still a thing.
Right.
Making that very case.
Yeah.
So I think that's the big difference between the two. I think they both have their places. And it all really boils down to individual choice. I like both. I use both. I moderate both. So I just do what I can to keep the community running.
Very, very good. And I want you to pick, if you don't mind, an alternate history moment of the week, something that's stood out over the past week in your online communications. What exactly have you come across that we should know about?
Like, in terms of stuff that's been posted?
Yeah, in terms of stuff that's been posted, in terms of pretty much anything, really. Anything that you've come across, any new books, perhaps, that you've come across. Anything over the past 7 days, really.
Like, new stuff, or, like, stuff I've read, because I can, like...
It can be new, it can be stuff that you've read.
One of the more obscure books I read for this podcast is this wonderful book available on Amazon Kindle called The Baton Balloon War by Walt Snedeker.
I like the name.
It's like... It's about a World War II where the British defeat Germany using like weather balloons with incendiaries.
Okay, interesting.
And the Americans defeat Japan using balloons with bats in them with incendiaries, and it's just... It's incredibly silly, but it's like the fun type of silly. So, if that sounds like fun, if you want like something that's kind of diesel punky, because there's a lot of stuff about the alternate tech they use. So I feel like that would appeal to some people. So yeah, Baton Balloon War by Walt Snedeker. That's what I recommend. That's a fun book.
Baton Balloon War. There you go. If you want to burst your enthusiasm for that, I think I may have to go and read that at some point.
Yeah,
I think I may have to.
It's a fun book. Short one, too.
And that may well be my... What interested me is I was reading up a little bit on this podcast as well. I was reading World War II, A Concise History, and I was reading a lot on the invasion of Sicily in particular. And to say, it was a lot I didn't know about, actually. A lot I didn't know about the campaign to invade Sicily, etc. I found out a lot more about that. And also on alternatehistory.com, I came across an interesting, very interesting discussion on the idea of an Anglo-French Union as well, which could have happened not only in 1940. It was actually proposed in 1940, but it didn't amount to anything. It was voted against. But only just, I have to say. But there was also a chance it could have happened in 1957 as well. So, unfortunately, it was an interesting conversation, but there wasn't much on it. There wasn't much on it. It seemed to peter out, as these sometimes do.
Yeah, I seem to remember there was a timeline about that for a while.
There was, yeah, I do remember that, actually, very vaguely, and it was kind of before I got into the idea of an Anglo-French Union, so I didn't read it, but I have got it somewhere. I may have to track that down and give it another read at some point.
Yeah, the Anglo-French Union was mentioned in that Battle of Britain book by James Holland I read.
Yeah.
And it was basically sort of a stopgap measure to keep the British commitment to France.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that I think would break up after the war.
But then there's always the chance that it wouldn't, because some so-called stopgap ideas end up persisting.
Yeah, like Northern Ireland.
So you're probably right on the whole, but there's always a chance.
I mean, I think one of the things that it prevents the whole Union from lasting long-term is the presence of Charles de Gaulle, who, will not let the British have too much power if he has anything to say about it.
Yeah.
So
of course, he famously... He famously, of course, vetoed the idea of the UK joining the then common market in 1958.
Yeah, exactly.
I know lots of Brexiteers who may agree with him on that in that regard. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that he would cooperate during the war, but like once it's over, he's like, yeah, we're leaving now.
Yeah.
Adieu. Bonsoir.
Vive la France, etc. Pretty much. Yeah. Okay. Alex, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It has been good. Just remind people of where to go on Facebook and where to go in terms of alternate timelines, just so people can catch up with what you're doing over the next month, because you are going to do a bit of a blog. You are going to do a bit of a blog post as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I want to get my blog back up and running.
Good.
It's called A Thing That Exists, because I couldn't think of a better title. And I had a bunch of stupid things that don't matter. I want to get back in that. I want to get writing again.
Yeah.
I want to go to Alternate History Online on Facebook.
Yeah.
The Alternate Timelines forums. Enter that into Google. You'll find it. It's a nice little place. Run by a guy named Lord Roll, and I'm his deputy. Me and this other guy. He's currently Roll's currently on vacation, but I can like help people get on and get settled and whatnot. Happy to do that. And I would also, of course, Ben, be very happy to be on the show again. In fact, I want to be on the show again.
Good. Needless to say, Alex, you will be on the show again. I will see to it. Thank you very much for joining me, as always. And thank you to you guys. I will also post a link on the Alternate History site regarding this particular show and details on how you can get involved as well. Join me next time we do the Alternate History show, where it's Anna in the UK, or at least 12th century England. We'll hear what happened in 1135 after the death of Henry I and how it led to an 18-year civil war. But could it have been prevented? And how could it have been prevented? And how could the ending of the civil war have been different? You'll hear more about that on next month's show at the end of September. See you for that. Meantime, goodbye and happy searching.